Bonsoir. I think we'll get started. Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Et bienvenue à la conférence John Peters Humphreys dans le domaine des droits de la personne. My name is Colleen Shepherd. I'm the director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. And on behalf of the Faculty of Law, and our center, I have the great pleasure of welcoming you to this important public lecture today. And before turning the floor over to my colleague, Professor René Provost, and there's been a slight change in the program. Unfortunately, Professor McDay, who was to be the moderator, had an emergency that came up, and so Professor Provost has kindly agreed to be the moderator. Before turning the floor over to Professor Provost, I wanted just to say a word about the origins and the importance of the John Humphrey lecture, and about John Humphrey himself. And John Humphrey was born in 1905 in New Brunswick, and he studied in New Brunswick and at McGill University. He then practiced law from 1929 until 1936, when he joined McGill's Faculty of Law. He taught for a number of years at McGill, both before and after his engagement as the first director of the Human Rights Division of the United Nations Secretariat. And he was appointed to the United Nations in 1946, at the time when the UN Secretariat was only a fledgling institution. And he continued his work there for 20 years. And one of the major contributions which he made was in consultation with doing preparatory work on the Commission on Human Rights, which was chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt. He was central in the preparation of the first preliminary draft of what became the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. Humphrey was a believer in international human rights and in international human rights mechanisms. He was an idealist and an advocate of quiet diplomacy to promote human rights. Even after he returned to McGill to teach, he continued to be involved in many initiatives with the United Nations. Now, this public lecture was established in 1988 to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the drafting of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the first lecture was delivered by Professor Humphrey himself back in 1988. And I thought I would leave you with the final words from his lecture in 1988, which I think are resonate with the theme of the lecture that we're anxious to hear by Professor Stephen Ratner this evening on After Atrocity, Optimizing UN Action Towards Accountability for Human Rights Abuses. What Professor Humphrey completed his lecture, and this was published in the McGill Law Review, was this. He said, let me finish on this note. The generation to which I belong has successfully enunciated international legal standards in the matter of human rights. But that is not enough. The challenge of the future, and I mean the immediate future, is how to set up efficient mechanisms for the enforcement and implementation of these standards. This will not be an easy thing to do, but is something that has to be done if this planet is to have any future. And I think that the lecture this evening will give us some guidance in how we move towards fulfilling Professor Humphrey's concerns and aspirations. So with that, I'll turn the floor over to my colleague, Professor Provost.
Okay, bonsoir tout le monde. Good evening, everyone. It's a real treat to welcome Stephen Ratner to the Faculty of Law at McGill University. There really are kind of a handful of creative and really inspiring international law scholars in the United States, and Professor Ratner certainly is one of them. I think that he's published several books. But my own impression, it might be a bias, but there is one of them on accountability for human rights atrocities in international law, which really was kind of a turning point in the way in which thinking about accountability in the field of international human rights takes place in international law. And I note that there are several editions. The first one, 1997, just before the creation of the International Criminal Court in 1998, and then later ones in 2001 and 2009. And I think that speaks to the nature of Stephen Ratner's scholarship, which tends to be, 1 year ahead of the events that everybody's going to write about. And so I note that he has a forthcoming book on the thin justice of international law, a moral reckoning of the law of nations, which sounds extremely intriguing, and perhaps we'll get a slice of that in today's talk. Stephen Ratner is going to talk about the role of the United Nations in ensuring accountability for human rights abuses, so a theme that he has been speaking about for a long time. And in doing that, he will no doubt rely on his own experience working within the structures of the United Nations, participating in working groups of experts on Cambodia and also Sri Lanka, two instances where the cry for accountability has been resonating for a very long time, and to this day not been fully answered, I would venture to say, in unanswered in different ways for Cambodia and Sri Lanka. He's also been an advisor to the Department of State, which I think is a useful training ground for international lawyers, because it tends, I think, to infuse a little bit of realism as to what can take place in the real life of states and international relations, and a little bit aside from a rather idealized version of international human rights law. Stephen Ratner is a graduate of Princeton, the Institut de Hautes Études Internationales à Genève, peut-être il pourrait nous parler un peu en français aussi tout à l'heure. And finally, of Yale Law School. So it's a great pleasure to leave the floor to Professor Ratner.
Thank you, René, for that very kind introduction. Merci beaucoup. C'est un très grand honneur d'être ici avec vous ce soir. Et ça va être la fin de mon français pour cet après-midi. I consider it a great honor to be here to deliver the John Humphrey Lecture. Humphrey led one of those lives within the United Nations that shaped what the organization has become today. One of the first generation of UN civil servants, he was to human rights what Ralph Bunche was for peacekeeping or Brian Urquhart for UN mediation. To read his diaries, so beautifully edited by your own John Hobbins, is to see a world that has in many ways vanished. A nearly entirely male club, mostly of Westerners, that hammered out new treaties and mechanisms over fine wine and cigars in many a European tourist destination, as well as lesser sites like Lake Success, New York, but also where the foundations were laid for projects still central to the UN's work. For without Humphrey's Division of Human Rights, there would be no Center for Human Rights, and then High Commissioner for Human Rights, with his vast secretariat in Geneva, and now field office presences around the world. Yet at the same time, I'm here to talk to you about a topic that was not the target of John Humphrey's energies: the UN's role in holding individuals accountable for human rights abuses. Individual accountability is a broad concept. It encompasses a range of processes that put the spotlight on individuals for human rights abuses they've committed, mete out consequences to them, and address in some meaningful way the legacy of the abuses on victims. Humphrey's cause, from drafting the Universal Declaration on, was to create norms and mechanisms for holding states responsible for violations of human dignity. Even though the Nuremberg trials had recently concluded, and indeed some of the lower-level trials were still being held while the UDHR was being drafted, creating norms and mechanisms for holding individuals accountable was not the priority for him, probably because it was seen as both less important and far more challenging than holding states accountable. In reviewing his many writings about the UN and human rights, I found that he barely wrote about the subject. His 1989 book, No Distant Millennium, had a brief treatment of the treaties on slavery, genocide, and torture, each of which makes those acts a crime for which individuals must be prosecuted, but he really focused on those treaties for the new obligations on states. Professor McDonald's long tribute to Humphrey in the 1991 Canadian Yearbook mentions it only once, citing a speech that Humphrey gave in 1988 calling for an international criminal court. So my talk today is about a project whose importance for the UN became apparent only in Humphrey's final years and in the two decades since his death. Other than a few reports and resolutions in the aftermath of the Nuremberg trials, both the member states and the secretariat have focused on individual accountability only since about 1992. In December of that year, the Security Council passed a binding resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, best remembered for its authorization to a coalition of 26 states to deliver food to civilians starving in Somalia. That resolution included a clause that condemned violations of international humanitarian law in Somalia, but significantly it also added that, quote, those who commit or order the commission of such acts will be held individually responsible. It's hard to know what the Security Council's members had in mind, given the absence of any Somali or international mechanisms for accountability at that time. Yet from that rather obscure starting point, we have seen the UN emphasize individual accountability both as violations occur and in their aftermath. Accountability's entrenchment in the UN today can be seen through institutional expertise within the various organs and many NGOs, routine references to it in Security Council and General Assembly resolutions, reports of numerous UN commissions, millions of pages of court documents from UN tribunals, and enormous scholarship as well. With a topic so imposing, the subject of my talk today is relatively modest. To ask what the United Nations can realistically do to foster processes of individual accountability in states that are unaccustomed to seeing their leaders and generals held to account for their crimes. I will approach this topic by asking and answering four questions. First, should the UN be in the business of pushing the project of individual accountability at all? Second, what are the modes of advancing accountability on which the UN should focus? Third, what conditions are necessary for successful involvement and furtherance of this goal? And fourth, what are the key pitfalls for the UN along the way? I aim to address all four of these in part through my lens of my academic work, but as Professor Povo said, also in light of the experiences I've had as a member of two UN accountability mechanisms: the Secretary General's Group of Experts for Cambodia and the Secretary General's Panel of Experts on Accountability in Sri Lanka. The first of these, which worked in 1998 and 99, made recommendations for holding Khmer Rouge leaders accountable for their atrocities in the mid-1990s. And the second, which operated in 2010 and 2011, made recommendations for Sri Lanka to take in the aftermath of atrocities by the government and the Tamil Tigers in the final 6 months of that state's civil war. So let me turn to the first question. Should the UN be in the business of promoting individual accountability at all? With the immense obstacles to fulfilling its primary goals, prevention of armed conflict, fostering respect for human rights, why should the UN take on a role that is not mentioned in the Charter, to achieve something for victims that is not listed as part of their human rights in the Universal Declaration, and to ask states to take action that is not included among their duties in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights? More than two decades after that resolution on Somalia, with billions spent on two ad hoc tribunals and accountability now normalized within the UN, I think it's still a fair question. For even as I've written about and participated in UN accountability processes, I've been pulled towards seeing prevention and termination of human rights violations as a far greater priority. I spent 2 years working in international institutions aimed at getting states and non-state actors to follow the rules ex ante, with little emphasis on accountability ex post. One was the High Commissioner on National Minorities of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, a senior European diplomat who, along with his staff, mediates tensions between governments and minority groups in Eastern Europe. The other was the International Committee of the Red Cross, the large Swiss-based NGO with missions all over the world's conflict zones, whose officials quietly try to persuade governments and armed groups to follow the laws of war. Neither spends much time pointing fingers at individuals, but seeks to prevent and terminate abuses first and foremost. Indeed, it's safe to say that their mission would be severely undercut if they focused on accountability. The key to answering this question about the UN lies in another inquiry. What is the point of individual accountability at all? We hear so many answers from the UN High Commissioner, from victims groups, from NGOs. It's about meeting out justice, criminal justice to the perpetrators. It's about so-called closure for the victims. It's about reparations. It's about national reconciliation. But all these arguments are incomplete for me. For instance, my own experiences with victims reinforces the truism that their claims are extraordinarily heterogeneous. Some want a trial of their abuser, some a confession, some a government acknowledgement of responsibility, some an apology, some a summary execution of their abuser, some their homes back, some reparations in the form of money, and some the body, alive or dead, of a loved one. How can holding individuals accountable, whether judicially or not, fulfill all these inconsistent demands? It cannot. So for me, the point of holding individuals responsible for human rights abuses, and ultimately the point of UN involvement in that project, is much more basic. It's about prevention. Prevention of further human rights abuses, and thus, in the end, domestic tranquility. The person who first made this connection clear to me was Thomas Hammarberg, a Swedish human rights defender who was the UN Special Representative for Cambodia in the mid-1990s. Hammarberg sensed that one of the root causes of Cambodia's continued tragedy of human rights violations by the government, at that time and to this very day led by the extremely effective Hun Sen, was a culture of impunity. That culture signaled to governmental leaders that they could violate rights without fear of personal consequences of any kind, not even public criticism. Hammarberg traced that pathology to the lack of any accountability for Cambodia's Khmer Rouge leaders, those who, from 1975 to 1978, killed a fifth of Cambodia's population. Though ousted from office by Vietnam's invasion, the Khmer Rouge leadership as of the late 1990s remained at large, and the full truth had never been told either. Hammarberg wanted to end that impunity, or at least make a dent in it, ultimately ginning up the gears of the UN to create the panel of experts on which I served, beginning a process that eventually led to trials of the handful of remaining Khmer Rouge leaders through a Cambodian UN hybrid tribunal that is now operating in Phnom Penh. And I saw the connection a decade later, in the aftermath of Sri Lanka's civil war. From the late 2008 to May 2009, the government, intent on ending Sri Lanka's 20-year civil war, squeezed the Tamil Tigers in the northeast part of the island in a relentless military barrage that probably killed tens of thousands of innocent civilians. In the months afterwards, the government denied that its action had led to any civilian deaths. Why was it so important to figure out a way to look into who was responsible on both sides for what happened? because it seemed as if Sri Lanka's contemporary history had revealed again that prior impunity simply lays the groundwork for the next round of atrocities. Just as earlier governments had never been held to account for violent tactics against Tamils and moderate Sinhalese, the current government saw a green light for its final assault on the northeast part of the island. So a failure to look into what happened in the end of that war was merely laying the seeds for more violence in the future. So as you see, the ultimate purpose of accountability is not, for me, truth, retribution, reparation, or even national reconciliation, though those are ingredients of it. It's rather about prevention of future conflict within and between nations. It offers a strategy that merely holding states responsible cannot do. International relations scholars have developed many theories for why states violate or comply with international rules. But I don't think we need to study much of that theory to know that when an individual leader or soldier believes that he will face consequences for breaking the rules, that he is less likely to do so. If we can pierce the veil of the state, break down its structure by identifying which institutions and individuals within it oversaw and committed the abuses, we have introduced a new dynamic of both deterrence and internal reform. In a way, it's the flip side of the notion of subsidiarity. Just as decisions and rules should be made at the closest level possible to those affected by them, so violations of rules should be identified and rectified at the closest level possible to those responsible for those violations. In philosophical terms, I suppose my view makes me fundamentally a consequentialist or utilitarian when it comes to accountability. It's not that I think the victims do not deserve justice or the perpetrators deserve punishment, the essence of a more Kantian approach to accountability. I myself have never been the victim of a serious crime, so I cannot put myself in their shoes. But I do think the preventive argument is the most powerful reason among them. In that respect, promoting individual accountability is central to the mission of the UN when it comes to promotion of peace, and not marginal to it. My position does not mean that individual accountability is sufficient or necessary to prevent future internal or interstate conflict. It is certainly not sufficient, for much else goes into conflict prevention. States like Canada and international organizations like the UN, concerned about promoting respect for human rights abroad, have only so much diplomatic and monetary capital to invest, and in some situations, individual accountability should not be the top priority as a preventive strategy. And I would argue that I'm not even convinced that it is always necessary. I would not rule out the possibility that a state that does not engage in that process can have a peaceful future. But in many situations where a culture of impunity is a cause of past conflict or a potential cause of future conflict, accountability is part of the solution. And if the state itself will not begin the process, then the UN has a responsibility under the Charter to get it to do so, a responsibility that derives from the consequences of impunity for internal peace. So if accountability fits within the UN's conflict prevention and human rights mandates, what is the right role for the UN as an institution in particular? Since that resolution on Somalia back in 1992, we have seen the UN try three approaches. One, typified by that resolution and dozens after it, is to remind the parties to the conflict or a government repressing its population that individuals should or even will be held responsible for human rights atrocities. But of course, such promises and reminders are fairly worthless if the UN and member states do nothing to actually jumpstart a process of accountability. So the second has been the creation of ad hoc criminal tribunals, those for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, fully international tribunals, and so-called hybrid tribunals in Sierra Leone, Cambodia, East Timor, and Lebanon. Now, as much as these tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda have brought many violators to justice, they are a very limited option for the UN for a few reasons. Criminal courts are expensive, especially the full-fledged UN courts. And in addition, these procedures deal only with one aspect of accountability and not the range of issues that need to be addressed as a conflict prevention strategy. Most important, as I will discuss more in a few minutes, conditions often do not make trials of former officials remotely realistic in the short term. The very elements that give individual punishment some added value over state responsibility as a response to human rights abuses create huge resistance when the UN proposes prosecuting governmental officials or leaders of non-state actor groups as well. The same resistance comes up in the case of universal jurisdiction, where one state proposes to prosecute the officials of another state. To see the difference between state accountability and individual accountability, one particularly poignant example is the outcome of the 1985 Rainbow Warrior episode, where France blew up a Greenpeace vessel in New Zealand, killing a Greenpeace activist on board. France and New Zealand were able to agree on the terms of compensation by France and admission of responsibility, but they sparred at length over the punishment of two French agents responsible for the murder, ending eventually in their extrication by France. In a word, when justice becomes personal, so do the reactions to it. So I turn to the third and, in my view, most promising role for the UN in terms of added value. The preliminary investigation of serious human rights violations, accompanied by the development and advocacy of options for the state to advance individual accountability. Whether done through formal commissions of inquiry, groups of experts, or otherwise, this process builds on a long tradition within the UN. It traces its legal pedigree to Article 36 of the Charter, which authorizes the Security Council to engage in something called enquiry, a fancy term for the determination of facts when they are contested by parties to a dispute. Building on the experience of the League of Nations, the drafters of the Charter understood that the mere clarification of facts can pave the way for two warring sides to negotiate the settlement of a dispute. In addition, Dag Hammarskjöld asserted the Secretary General's inherent authority to engage in fact-finding under Article 99 of the Charter. And the General Assembly recognized the importance of fact-finding in a key resolution in 1991. As a result, the Secretary General and various commissions of the Security Council have done precisely this sort of activity in numerous interstate disputes since the UN's founding. And just as figuring out the facts contributes to the possibility of solutions to interstate disputes, so in the aftermath of human rights atrocities, the mere clarification of facts is a huge step forward. This is particularly true if one party simply offers a narrative that denies any responsibility for atrocities. And indeed, as Hammarskjöld first demonstrated decades ago, the UN has a special credibility when it comes to fact-finding. The Internationalized Secretariat helps rebut charges by individuals or states being investigated that the UN is doing one state's bidding. Yet that credibility does not come solely from the Secretariat. And in fact, relying on the Secretariat alone for such projects is not wise. For the Secretariat is, by its nature, extremely cautious and will not want to offend powerful member states in their report writing. More important, the Secretary General and interested member states will have greater leverage to work with the report's conclusions if they can say that they in no way influence the content of the report. Thus, fact-finding bodies, at least in the area of human rights, have been and need to be headed by outsiders not beholden to the UN bureaucracy or the member states. Their independence creates a distance between their final report and those who will use it, permitting the Secretary General or others seeking to promote accountability to take a sort of political cover behind the reputation of the commissioners. With that credibility, however, comes a responsibility. It means that UN investigations must be impartial and thorough. It means that mandates of investigative bodies must be even-handed, addressing the violations of both sides, or more than one, or more than two sides if necessary. That commissioners must be chosen to avoid even the appearance of partiality, and that investigators must be chosen who have open minds and specialized skills. Even with all these ingredients, some states may not find the UN to be a credible agent to gather facts. But unlike the investigation by another government or even a well-respected NGO, which would typically be funded by Western sources, in the case of UN involvement, the burden will be on the state to show that the UN is biased. Fact-finding itself is only one aspect of that third UN approach. The UN's credibility and expertise also give it the ability, and indeed I would say the responsibility, to do more. To explain whether and how the abuses violate international law, and most important, to explain what response is expected of the actors involved in the wake of such atrocities. Explain to whom? First and foremost to the state, its citizens, and its government, to to guide and nudge them in a direction that will be to the state's long-term advantage, but also to other actors, foreign states and civil society, who can use their influence to get the government to do what it must. And the UN has indeed made huge strides in explaining to states what is expected of them in terms of responses. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and outside experts have canvassed treaty law and best practices to come up with a set of international standards, from the so-called Joinet principles on impunity to the toolkit on transitional justice developed by the High Commissioner. The UN has elaborated on what states need to do if they want to have an effective process of truth-telling, reparations, criminal justice, disqualification from office, or other strategies. These standards do not represent a one-size-fits-all requirement for all states, and much of them are more what international lawyers call soft law rather than binding treaty rules. But nonetheless, they give states a sense of what it means to be responsible in today's world when it comes to accountability in the aftermath of mass atrocities. Having described why the UN should be a leading player on promoting individual accountability and why what I believe to be its most promising role, this idea of fact-finding, I now want to offer what I regard as the necessary conditions for successful UN engagement. Now, this is a tricky task. The UN's experience in human rights fact-finding now encompasses about 30 panels over the last few decades, depending on how one counts. Not all of these have addressed or been aimed at promoting the responsibility of individuals. At this stage, neither the UN nor academia has done a comprehensive evaluation of the results of each of these missions. So I propose to look at the question in more strategic and structural terms, to offer, based on my own observations of the processes that I have followed, what I would regard as the most important variables affecting the success of fact-finding missions. But we already see a definitional thicket on the horizon for what is success for the UN when it comes to promoting individual accountability and combating impunity. Success is not putting most abusers on trial, it is not satisfying most victims, and it is not revealing the whole truth. Rather, success varies from state to state. Yet its minimal core, to me, is the initiation of a process that will hold individuals accountable in some way for their actions and lay some seeds for ending a culture of impunity. That should ideally include at least one of the following: investigation of credibly alleged violations, a national dialogue in which victims can speak to the government, a fair public account of events, or an acknowledgement of wrongdoing and apology. The UN can really do no more than encourage, or if that fails, push a state to do these, and its success or failure may not be evident for years after the process starts. Perhaps in another generation, we can define success with a higher set of expectations on the UN. But at this fairly early stage in seeking to get governments to hold individual accountables, this minimal core seems enough of a goal for the UN. In my view, the success of UN engagement is a product of three factors: transitions, alliances, and creativity. The first factor is the transition. That is the status of the political transition within the state, the movement, if any, away from the regime that committed the abuses. Tina Rosenberg's observations from her magnificent 1995 book, The Haunted Land, Facing Europe's Ghost After Communism, ring as true as ever. As she explained in contrasting the experiences of Latin America and Eastern Europe in dealing with their past, the strength of the successor regime, along with the extent and type of abuses endured by the country, exerts a powerful influence on the course that accountability takes. The same holds true regarding the success of UN involvement in promoting accountability. Where the former regime is gone and discredited, as was the case with Cambodia's Khmer Rouge or Rwanda's Genocidal regime, both overthrown militarily, the government will typically be quite receptive to accountability. Where at the other extreme, the government that committed the abuses is still in power, where in a word there is no transition, as with Sri Lanka since 2009, The obstacles to accountability are enormous, maybe even insurmountable for as long as that regime is in power. The same holds true for the recommendations of the UN Human Rights Council's Investigatory Commission on Syria, or those of the Independent Commission investigating the 2011 events in Bahrain. There are few, if any, examples of a regime that commits massive violations of human rights and then proceeds to investigate its own leaders. Indeed, even where there's a formal transition, but the abusers retain informal levers of power, the government will resist accountability. In the case of Cambodia, Hun Sen endorsed the idea of trials for the Khmer Rouge, but he also wanted to make sure that any UN tribunal would investigate only those who were very old and fully discredited, and not other former Khmer Rouge members who were now his allies in government or his partners in business. In these sorts of cases, the government will refuse to apply the impressive standards developed by the UN under the rubric of transitional justice, and it will refuse to fulfill the duties it has accepted in treaties. But the UN can at least lay the groundwork for future accountability once the people of the state have decided one way or the other that they have had enough of those who committed the atrocities. Now, whereas the first factor, the transition, is internal to the state, the second factor, what I call alliances, is external to it. By alliances, I'm referring to the political connections between the elites in the state and those outside of it. Where the government has powerful allies within the United Nations, and here I mean the member states, the possibility that the UN will undertake investigations, let alone step in and create something like an ad hoc tribunal, is significantly reduced. Where the government lacks such allies, the UN will have a freer rein. In other words, alliances help determine the leverage of the United Nations, whether it can take the first step of looking into the past atrocities and later persuade the state to make moves in the direction of accountability. Alliances will also influence which part of the UN will take the lead on fact-finding, or whether the UN itself will play a role. If a permanent member of the Security Council is a friend of a government committing the abuses, the Security Council is out as a venue for creating an investigatory body. But the Human Rights Council may not be, and the Secretary General himself may initiate action if those alliances preclude action by a political body, although he too may have reasons not to challenge a particular country as well. In this context, one can contrast the willingness of the Security Council to create commissions of inquiry for Darfur and for Lebanon with the absence of Security Council investigations of Syria in its civil war, of the two sides in the Gaza war, of North Korea, or even of something like civilian casualties caused by drone attacks in Pakistan. With the Council blocked, the Human Rights Council, with the Security Council blocked, the Human Rights Council created commissions of inquiry for Syria and Gaza and North Korea. And the Council's thematic mechanisms offer some kind of review, if not a real, although not quite a real investigation, of civilian casualties caused by the drone strikes. Sometimes member states block action in all the UN's political organs, and here I want to return to Sri Lanka. Despite Sri Lanka's size and relatively insignificant strategic position, Sri Lanka has many allies in the UN system. Like talented jazz musicians, the Rajapaksa brothers have played the G77 sovereignty tune in many keys, with many riffs, with many states. China, which sees investment opportunities there, will support it to the hilt. And the states that care most about accountability in the end have little leverage, little more than embarrassing the government a little bit by not showing up at a Commonwealth meeting. As a result, while many officials within the UN saw a need to get an accountability process started within Sri Lanka, the writing was on the wall in 2009 that neither the Security Council, nor the General Assembly, nor the Human Rights Council would initiate any investigation. Nor would Sri Lanka request UN assistance, a hook that had allowed the Secretary General to create other commissions on his own, such as that investigating the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. When the Secretary General saw the impossibility of approval from a political organ for a full commission, he created the panel of experts on which I served. Sensing that Sri Lanka's supporters might see the panel as an end run around the political organs, he deliberately devised a mandate that never used the word investigation, but instead was focused on giving advice to the Sri Lankan government on international standards and best practices regarding accountability. At the same time, officials within the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights ensured that our mandate included the phrase that the panel would have, quote, regard for the nature and scope of alleged violations, a clause that allowed our group to offer detailed views on which allegations were credible enough to merit a full investigation. I turn now to the third necessary condition for success in UN efforts to promote accountability, creativity. Creativity is a little different from the other two in that it is neither internal to the state nor a matter of interstate relations, but internal to the UN itself. For accountability is no different from the rest of the UN's human rights project in this regard, where progress is slow and new venues and approaches must constantly be invented. Creativity encompasses many virtues, including persistence through short-term defeat, compromise, and diplomacy. In the case of Cambodia, the group of experts recommended in March 1999 a full-fledged ad hoc tribunal to try the Khmer Rouge because we concluded that Cambodian courts could not mete out impartial justice. Our central recommendation was not, however, accepted by Secretary General Annan, who instead opened up negotiations between his lawyers and the Cambodian government on a hybrid UN-Cambodia tribunal. Those talks took 4 years to complete, and the Secretary General, along with some prodding by the General Assembly, compromised along the way. He accepted the key Cambodian demands for a tribunal with the majority Cambodian judges, Cambodian-appointed judges, and two co-prosecutors, one from the UN and one picked by the Cambodian government. Now, I personally think that all these compromises were a huge mistake and wonder whether the effort has been worth it for the conviction by the hybrid tribunal of three very old Khmer Rouge leaders. But I recognize that others see this as a partial success. And most important, I don't object to the notion of compromise for its own sake. Responding to political realities is essential for some process to succeed, and I cannot at least offer any grand theory for when compromise has gone too far. Creativity and persistence also prove critical with respect to Sri Lanka. There, Ban Ki-moon's pivot to create the panel of experts in the face of lack of support within the political organs was, in my view, inspired. Indeed, I think it can be a model for future UN action by the SG to assert the UN's responsibility regarding accountability, even when the member states and the political organs refuse to do so. However, after the panel's report was issued, it very unfortunately became clear that the Secretary General would not follow our key recommendation to create a full-fledged commission of inquiry on his own. So governments and NGOs turned their energies again to the Human Rights Council. The results? A broad coalition of states in the Council passed resolutions in 2012 and 2013 critical of the government and urging it to do something serious on the accountability front. When Sri Lanka still did nothing, the Office of the High Commissioner, member states, and NGOs persisted, and the Council at last authorized, in this past March, OHCHR to conduct a full investigation, which is now underway. Now, I'm not fully satisfied with either the Secretary General's passing of the buck to the Human Rights Council, nor the Council's ultimate resolution. It is way short of a full-fledged commission of inquiry, and the funding is not what it needs to be. But I do think it's a major step forward in investigating that which the government will not. And that takes me to the final issue for today: the traps that the UN, the Secretariat, and the member states need to avoid in the pursuit of individual accountability. I want to speak here about traps rather than shortcomings, because I think the latter topic could occupy a whole conference. We know the UN has much to do to improve the internal workings of individual fact-finding bodies. Suffice it to say that these bodies lack necessary funding from the member states and institutional support within the Secretariat, and they often have to reinvent the wheel in their operations. As for traps, in my view, there are four of them. First is what I will call the international criminal law trap. Many advocates of accountability, for the very best of reasons, wish to see the atrocities and the perpetrators solely through the lens of criminal law. Because we can legally characterize the perpetrators' actions as war crimes, crimes against humanity, or occasionally even genocide, the first recourse or best mechanism of accountability becomes criminal trials. And if the state cannot undertake them, then the remedy on which the international community should focus is the International Criminal Court in The Hague. For these advocates, commissions of inquiry may be a useful start, but their key purpose is to gather evidence that will be handed over to a domestic or international prosecutor. This international criminal law approach strikes me as extremely short-sighted, cutting off one's nose to spite one's face. First, in situations where atrocities are ongoing, termination is more important than accountability. Thus, the Human Rights Council's Commission on Syria focused on cessation first, barely mentioning accountability. And the report of the Commission on Libya is also very guarded in this respect. In rare cases, criminal accountability can serve as a means to end ongoing violations. Certainly, the marginalization of Radovan Karadzic after his indictment by the ICTY is the key example. But most of the time, the UN should make ending the abuses the priority. Second, even after atrocities, the international criminal law approach ignores the reality that accountability is a gradual process, and a consensus must be built for it. One cannot simply move directly to putting a state's leaders or former leaders in the dock, and certainly not in the ICC. A demand by the UN for immediate trials of named individuals, when a state has no willingness to do so, will merely allow opponents of accountability to accuse the UN of undermining state sovereignty and wanting nothing more than the heads of governmental leaders. Thus, in the case of Sri Lanka, contrary to a number of key NGOs, including the International Crisis Group, our report never recommended criminal trials at the domestic or international level. Rather, realistically, the first step needed to be some kind of full investigation of the atrocities, if not by the government, then by the UN. Had we advocated ICC trials, it would have made it extremely difficult for groups within Sri Lanka to support our report without being accused of being traitors. A proposal to have the ICC investigate the Sri Lankan war would also have been futile, because the court has no jurisdiction over the atrocities there. Sri Lanka is not a party to the ICC statute, meaning that the only way the court can legally investigate the events there was through a referral by the Security Council, the possibility for which was, and frankly still is, zero. Certainly, referral to the ICC in some situations can be an important part of accountability. And indeed, it may be so in the half dozen situations that are currently the subject of trials in that court. But the limited jurisdiction of the ICC and the immense resistance that states often put up to handing over people to it means that even if you do believe in criminal justice as the core element of accountability, the court's utility is still limited. A second and somewhat related pitfall is what I would call the legalist trap. Advocates of accountability fall into that trap when they see accountability, or the UN's role in it, purely in legal terms. Getting states to meet their legal duties under treaties, for instance, and not as a fundamentally political process. The result can be NGO reports, recommendations, or academic pieces with a remarkably tin ear for the realities of a post-atrocity situation. In fact, one of the key goals for any UN panel investigating the facts and making recommendations, certainly it was for us in the Sri Lanka report, must be to gain domestic support for accountability, first and foremost, with international support critical as well. That does not mean ignoring a state's legal obligations and international standards, but a report that speaks only of a state's legal duties and not, for instance, of the importance to the state of accountability in a way sensitive to the politics of the country will resonate well with law professors, but not with politicians and civil society. Politics does and should affect the interpretation of a commission's mandate, the tone of the report, and the recommendations. Fact-finding, then, demands political expertise and awareness among those undertaking it, and not just legal expertise. And without a doubt, the follow-up to the work of any panel by states and NGOs that wish to promote accountability demands exceptional political skills. Third, and in contradistinction to the other two traps, is what I will call the selectivity trap. UN fact-finding cannot maintain credibility with the broad membership, and even more important, with the target of the inquiry, if it is seen as doing only the bidding of certain groups of states. Decisions to investigate only one side in a war, or to investigate one set of atrocities but not another, over time erode the credibility of fact-finding. Some of this can be addressed through the work of the thematic rapporteurs of the Human Rights Council, who can address any country's violations that fall within their mandate, but most of them lack the resources for serious investigations. So here I think that the selectivity problem invites a special role for the Secretary General. If state interests skew the work of the political bodies, the Secretary General should be prepared to create new mechanisms of some kind. Fourth and finally is the defeatist trap. Those who fall into this see the obstacles to accountability as so insurmountable that they want to wait for a better time or pass the buck to someone else to do the hard diplomatic work. In the aftermath of our Cambodia report, despite a clear international consensus on the gravity of the Khmer Rouge's crimes, most states did not want to do anything at all about bringing its leaders to justice. Perhaps that could be chalked up to the amount of time that had elapsed since the atrocities, more than 25 years. On the theory that it was just as well to let sleeping dogs lie, or due to the cost of a new ad hoc UN tribunal. But how do we justify the same reaction by most states to the more modest call for an international investigation in the immediate aftermath of the Sri Lankan civil war? For even after our report placed the UN imprimatur of credibility on the allegations of atrocities and revealed the big lie of the government, many states waited for others to take the lead within the UN, even states like Canada that had said they really cared about accountability. In that case, it was the leadership of one individual, Eileen Donohoe, the ambassador to the Human Rights Council from the US, who mobilized the State Department juggernaut and eventually persuaded a majority of council members to pass the first serious resolution on accountability in Sri Lanka. States will need to continue to press the targets of UN inquiries to act on the recommendations of the bodies, or they become dead letters over time. A look at the recommendations of many such bodies reveals the gap between them and governmental action. So politics, diplomacy, compromise, yes. But waiting for someone else to act or just allowing time to take its course, it's really, to me, just a way that a government can convince itself that something will happen when it really will not. So let me conclude by quoting the words of John Humphrey. For despite his orientation towards state accountability, he did recognize the importance of holding individuals responsible. In No Distant Millennium, his 1989 book, he quoted Lester Pearson's remarks in Parliament in 1952 regarding the 1948 Genocide Convention, the first UN treaty to make a crime out of a human rights violation. Pearson told Parliament that, quote, it is perhaps possibly the most important source of new international law which has developed since the last war, that of the Genocide Convention. And Humphrey added in his book, quote, insofar as the convention, like the war crimes trials after the Second World War, weakens the principle of collective responsibility and strengthens that of personal responsibility, Mr. Pearson's statement was probably true. Now, I'm not sure that individual accountability is more important than state accountability. Perhaps Pearson's hyperbole was just to get the Parliament to ratify the convention. I think Humphrey certainly had his priorities right in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. But there can be no doubt that holding individuals accountable is now a highly significant method to promote compliance with international human rights law, even as it is threatening to some state officials, as human rights law remains threatening to governments. The structure that Humphrey and his colleagues built for holding states accountable now has sprouted a new wing in that organic, decentralized, and somewhat disorganized and chaotic way that the UN has grown in other areas. We now need to think very hard about how to shore up that wing and integrate it into the UN's greater missions in the promotion of human rights and the preservation of peace. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Ratner. So we have 30 minutes for discussion. I would ask that you step up to one of the microphones because the acoustics is very bad in this room when you're actually trying to hear what somebody is saying from the audience. So I invite you to bring up your questions. Yes, sir.
I'm going to be somewhat controversial. I've spent a lifetime studying and teaching history and have come to the conclusion that a failed revolution is worse than no revolution because of all of the negative consequences, including especially that minor successes are used to justify major failures, which is precisely where the UN is today. It has not stopped the major genocides. It's done nothing for child poverty, for indigenous rights, for women's harassment. The list goes on and on. And instead of dealing with structural responsibilities, you're now suggesting adding the wrinkle of individual responsibility as a way of dealing with these issues. It seems to me that falls in the lines of fairy tales rather than reality. Now, I know you mean well, and we can certainly quote some minor examples, but I don't think it really deals with the major issues.
Well, thank you for that reaction. I guess just a couple of very brief responses, which is I am not the one proposing that the UN deal with accountability. Accountability goes back to 1945 with the Nuremberg trials, and so it was really somebody else's idea, and the drafting of the treaties that provide for accountability is not my idea. But I want to take your larger point, which is really that I'm sort of making much out of a very small record of success and paying no attention to the failures. And this raises larger questions that are beyond the scope of my talk and on which there's just enormous disagreement. I suppose it all depends on how you define success and failure. And I think those of us who have seen the UN situations where the UN does not get involved and situations where the UN does get involved, have actually noticed that there are enough situations where the UN's involvement makes a marginal difference or a great difference that it's sort of it's not really looking at the whole picture to just point out the failures. No one ever expected the UN to end war. No one ever expected the UN to end human rights atrocities. And so to put that sort of standard on any kind of international organization and then criticize it for not having achieved it, I think is not really consistent with what states actually expect international organizations to do.
Just for clarification, and I won't take too much time.
I would ask you actually to leave the next person. You had a good long question. I would ask you please to cede the mic. So, please.
Thank you very much, Stephen. That was such a packed talk. My mind is overstimulated. I think I have a lot of questions. But I really liked, I think, how you defined success. And I also liked how you have this very, I think, integrationist project about trying to think about how individual accountability fits into a kind of the fundamental mission of the UN, you know, why it was formed in the first place, which had to do with basically peace, right? So I like how you connect those two things together. But you also acknowledged at one point that, well, there is now just a presumption that culture of impunity might have a causal contribution to, you know, the ongoing nature of some civil wars and international conflict. So this presumption then leads you to support at least the kind of, you know, basic role that the UN can play in terms of fact-finding and so on. So my question was, do you think, well, so I guess in the hard cases, you know, you're basically saying, though, that it may be that it's just not going to actually be causally necessary in all cases. And I suppose one question is just, is it just a matter of political judgment when it is, or do you want to see more a kind of institutionalized minimum fact-finding mission sort of protocol to be established? And then the, another question about mechanisms is, what do you think about the universal periodic reviews that states are engaged in now? Is that a potential mechanism for, you know, at least bringing up some of these cases? Like you said, there's a problem of selectivity and, you know, the politics and of the alliances that prevent things from coming up. But is that a place? I'm not sure because I don't know enough about it, but maybe you can say something about that mechanism.
Okay. Well, on the first question about how do we know whether impunity is a cause of conflict, I don't think we can generalize, and I think every state is different. And the two episodes that I happen to have worked on, which is an X equals two, it's not exactly the full list of 30-odd commissions that the UN has worked on. I think that impunity was a factor. I think it's a factor in a lot of the others. If you look at Libya or Syria or Darfur, I think the impunity of governmental officials in the past has a link to the abuses that are in the more recent times. But I think the two caveats that I would make is, one, I do think there are situations where accountability has to take the back burner to prevention. And I think it is far more important to terminate ongoing abuses than it is to deal with the prevention of future abuses if you can only do one. And sometimes, given diplomatic resources, you can only do one. And then the second caveat is that I think there are, situations where it's not clear that dealing with the past is going to have a direct effect on the future. And, the examples that are often brought out in the literature on transitional justice are Spain and Mozambique, neither of which had a truth-telling or accountability process, which don't, and of course that doesn't mean the society isn't scarred in some sense, and that there aren't ghosts in the closet and there aren't, ongoing secrets and tensions and grudges, but that's still different from, the renewal of domestic strife. And so those are, I think, examples. I think they show that it is not always necessary. How does the UN know in a given instance whether or not it should address accountability? I don't have a theory for this, and I think it's something actually that political scientists and legal academics need to think about. I think that generally each commission has kind of decided on its own the extent to which it wants to emphasize individual accountability. Now, ours had a mandate to emphasize it. We were called the Panel on Accountability. But other commissions have decided that, maybe they don't want to focus on accountability, or maybe they just want to focus on certain aspects of it, not others. And I think that's just kind of a political judgment about what's feasible at the time. On your second question about UPR, it's just like a lot of the UN when it comes to human rights. I mean, there's some good things about UPR and there's some bad things about UPR. The theory of UPR was that, make sure that every state has a chance to be reviewed by the Human Rights Council in a way that wasn't possible under the Commission's rules, and it's not possible with respect to states that aren't parties to the treaty bodies which review their reports. And to the extent that, every state has been reviewed under UPR or is in the process of review, that is a success. It allows NGOs to file reports. It allows for the UN to write its own, the Human Rights Council to write its own reports that can be used by domestic NGOs. That's the good side. The bad side is that, it really is a kind of once over lightly. They don't emphasize all human rights equally. Sometimes they give states a very hard time for what are, I think, are fairly insignificant problems, and they gloss over for some other states that are powerful within the council some very serious problems. And so we shouldn't, we should not kid ourselves. The council is still a political body. And so even though there's this institutionalized process, the outcome of the reports is still reflecting the membership of the body.
Thank you, Professor. That was wonderful. But I got two questions. You presented the United Nations as an independent body, whereas it's more intergovernmental. And again, that makes it complicated in my understanding for the fact that this is a governmental agency trying to audit itself, because most of the people or the agencies that perpetrate some of these abuses and acts are government agencies. So how would a governmental agency account to itself? So I would love to get your understanding on that. And the next question is on the aspect of pursuit for justice as an individual. How do individuals have flexible access to pursuit for justice or make some of these government agencies accountable? Thank you.
Okay. I think on your first question, you know, the UN, like every intergovernmental organization, is both intergovernmental. Is both intergovernmental and independent, right? I mean, yes, it's composed of member states, but it has an independent secretariat, whose employees are theoretically, at least, loyal to the organization and don't take orders from member states. I mean, the UN has been investigating and commenting on its own members since its creation. I mean, that's not anything new, that the idea that an intergovernmental body can audit, criticize its own members is exactly why we have these bodies, because they have more credibility, because you're sort of part of a club. It's just basic, you know, international relations theory of why we have international organizations. So I don't think there's anything different about the UN in the area of human rights in that regard. I mean, yes, the UN is criticized, the UN through independent mechanisms of the secretariat or outside commissioners is criticizing its own members, and then sometimes the political bodies take up those through resolutions or other bodies and criticize individual members. That's, I think, part and parcel of what an international organization does. What I would just add as sort of a slightly different angle on that, because it seems to be maybe implicit in your question, is in what sense is the UN ever accountable as an institution? Because in fact, you know, the UN as an institution can make some serious mistakes. We have peacekeepers that are accused of bringing cholera into Haiti. We have peacekeepers that are accused of raping civilians in Central Africa. We have the question about whether the UN didn't protest loudly enough during the Sri Lankan civil war, and those are very, very important questions. And the UN has mechanisms. Sometimes they call on outside experts to write report about their own work. There are some very, very devastating reports written by outside panels of the UN's actions in Srebrenica during the Rwandan massacre. So it is possible for the UN to ask outsiders to examine the way the UN itself behaved in these situations. The role for individuals, this is a very important question. I think it's all about networking and NGOs and appealing to your own government. I mean, you know, if you're a national of a state that's responsive to views of politicians, and politicians are responsive to individual demands, then you work through your representatives to get your government to take a certain position. And I think, you know, that's affected Canada's position on lots of human rights issues. If you don't have that access, or even if you do, you work through coalitions of NGOs, you support international NGOs, you support local NGOs, but there are lots and lots of ways of getting, of making a difference as an individual.
Hello, thank you for your presentation. Basically, from the presentation, I got sort of the feeling that it's really the Secretary General who should be quite creative in inventing the ways how to make the fact-finding for the purposes of making the people accountable. And that doesn't seem to be a very institutionalized, so to say, kind of solution. It's really very fluid and flexible. And from that, I would have two questions. I still don't believe that there'll be a chance within the next years to change the attitude of the governments towards the accountability, international accountability. And the governments most probably will find every way to put obstacles to that. So the two ideas if you may comment, would be, is it possible to think of an institutionalized, for example, trust fund within UN, on making the national investigations on the atrocities, but led not by the government, but by the non-governmental actors, civil societies, academia, civil activists. So this sort of solution. And another question is slightly different. Okay, there are some limitations with the International Criminal Court, and you've addressed this during your part on the first trip. Still, International Criminal Court is really a landmark, basically, achievement in the fight against international impunity. And surprisingly, it has commanded quite a serious support by now, with over 110, I think, 20 countries who ratified the Rome Statute. So it's quite an achievement. There are very few conventions, human rights conventions, which in a short term manage to command such a wide support for this instrument. So is it possible maybe to reform the International Criminal Court in order to incorporate some of your recommendations of making it more flexible, maybe reforming the preliminary procedures by the prosecutor's office, who initially doesn't start the case itself, he first runs some sort of assessment, preliminary assessment of situation, in order to serve both ends, the end of the mere facts finding, and on some of the cases, if there will be a possibility and the context will be good, starting the proper criminal case. Thank you.
Okay. It is true that I put a lot of emphasis on the Secretary General. I don't have a lot of heroes in the world of sort of international politics, but Dag Hammarskjöld is one of them. And I think that Hammarskjöld shows that actually a move by the Secretary General that seems ad hoc at first can become institutionalized and a precedent because subsequent Secretary Generals invoke it. I mean, that's the way the UN works. The first thing that they ask is, well, did we ever do this before? And if they discover that some prior Secretary General did it. So I don't think there's any sort of tension between the idea of the Secretary General taking the action and that not being institutionalized. It's just a different form of institutionalization. But I think it's a more nimble one. I think it's one that has the potential to be more independent some of the ways in which the governments, you know, obviously control the political organs. Obviously, the Secretary General has, you know, only a certain margin of maneuver. He can't do something that is, you know, completely against the will of the member states because they'll deal with him in the budget or they won't reelect him or there are different ways that they have of making his life difficult. But I do think that he has the flexibility, and I think, again, this goes way, you know, this goes back to Hammarskjöld when he and Lester Pearson, you know, came up with the idea of UN peacekeeping, that the political organs don't have. And I think that's just part of what it means to be an executive or a chief executive officer in terms of your ability to respond more quickly to crises. On your second question, I think the idea of the trust fund for national investigations is a very creative idea. I'm not so sure that I think it's so great to have it run by, or let me put it this way, I don't think that we should assume that asking non-state actors to run it is going to solve all the problems, because non-state actors can be just as biased as governments. Some non-state actors are controlled by governments. Some non-state actors have their own, you know, dirty hands. And the fact is that, you know, asking, just saying we're going to outsource this to a non-state actor, civil society, you know, is going to raise huge problems. You know, respected academics, well, you know, there may not be respected academics in the country, or every academic might be afraid of his or her, where his or her paycheck is coming from, that they may not feel free to work on some kind of a body. So that's, again, where I think the trust fund might be an interesting idea, but maybe, again, it has to revert to the UN as the place where the investigations take place. On your final question about the ICC, I certainly did not mean to suggest that the ICC was not a major development, because it clearly is a very, very important development. But the fact is the court's, you know, been around for 13, the court's been, you know, operational since 2002. It has five situations. Most of the state's parties to the ICC statute are never going to actually be the kinds of countries that have cases before it. And most of the countries that have situations that are likely to come before the court are not parties to the statute, and that's exactly why they haven't ratified. So I think there is that sort of built-in limitation. I think the prosecutor is trying to do some of what you're talking about, in that the prosecutor, both the first prosecutor and the current prosecutor, do take the idea of complementarity very seriously. I think that they really understand that their goal is not just to grab up every case and indict just because the situation has been referred to them either by a state or by the Security Council, but that they really have a goal of trying to work with the national government and get a sense of whether that government can investigate and even help them, so that they don't have to, you know, have a situation where the government is unwilling or unable to investigate. So I think that the court can play a role in that. I don't think that really requires any reform of the statute. I think it's already built into the idea of complementarity. But I think that, again, the court can't even get a situation and be helpful to national authorities if the state is not a party to the statute and the Security Council doesn't refer the situation. It can't just on its own. You know, you can't just have the prosecutor say, well, I think that I have some ideas for the Israelis about what they should do to investigate Gaza. Well, Israel's not a party to the statute. Palestine's not a party to the statute. The Security Council hasn't referred the Gaza situation. He just can't on his own decide, I want to help out, unless the case has been referred to him.
Once again, thank you for the presentation. I was wondering what your thoughts would be on the international tribunal, and maybe more precisely the one for Rwanda, about the fact that it was criticized and questioned on its legitimacy, since the international community didn't intervene in the conflict, and that part of the population thought that maybe what happened in the country should stay in the country, and that what happens in one country is a matter of the citizen of that country and not of the international community. And therefore that the tribunal doesn't have the right or legitimacy to judge the accountability of the people that conducted the genocide. Thank you.
I guess I reject both of those arguments. I mean, yeah, sure, it's an outrage. It's one of the great black spots on the UN that it didn't, that this, and on the member states in particular, but also on members of the Secretariat, that the UN didn't intervene in Rwanda in 1994. But does that make the tribunal illegitimate? I mean, no more than it does if a police somehow, you know, drop the ball on investigating somebody who's suspected or maybe on the verge of committing a murder. If they drop the ball, it doesn't make it illegitimate for the state to then have a trial of the person. I just don't buy that at all. And on the national sovereignty argument, I mean, you know, human rights law is way past the national sovereignty argument. I think that, you know, ever since Nuremberg and frankly long before, we've accepted the notion of crimes against humanity. The Rwandans actually were not opposed to this tribunal. What they didn't like was the idea that it didn't have the death penalty. That's the only reason why, when they were on the Security Council, when the tribunal was created, the new government, they voted against it. You know, they don't like the idea that the tribunal might investigate RPF members, Kagame's people, but they're not opposed to the idea that there would be an international tribunal for what happened in Rwanda. They don't say that this is totally a Rwandan issue. So I think even, you know, I think those claims that the international community has no business, I just don't buy it. Now, does that mean that the best recourse is the ICC? No, it doesn't. The best justice is still that justice conducted at home. But that's not the same as saying that there's no interest, legitimate interest by the international community in what happens in terms of accountability.
Okay, one last question.
Thank you very much, Professor Ratner. I'm hoping that I could have your thoughts on something that plagues me about these issues, which is, you know, to the extent that impunity is kind of a feeling or a suspicion, to what extent do you worry that by really laying everything bare, we're sort of confirming the suspicion, right? That in fact this atrocity did happen, and in fact, if there is no follow-up, then we've really made the case that there is impunity in fact. And then the sort of related question of what that means in terms of norm erosion. You know, two decades ago, the U.S. in addressing the situation in Rwanda didn't use the word genocide. In the last decade, we've seen them use words like genocide and torture, and yet they're not to be the same. You know, we expected that to have an impact, a normative and legal impact, to have consequences, and when it hasn't, again, are we confirming some suspicions about the strength of these norms, perhaps illusions that might be better left, you know, unburst, balloons that are better left unburst.
Okay, very interesting. Well, I suppose that, you know, when a commission of a fact-finding body issues a report that shows just how horrible something really was, and, you know, in an unbiased, impartial way, and then proceeds to show how nothing has been done about it, it is highlighting the fact that there's impunity. But I'd rather highlight the fact that there's impunity than continue the narrative that there's no need for punishment, which is typically the narrative of the governments. You know, in other words, I mean, why would you need to punish if we didn't do anything wrong? So yes, it does highlight the existence of impunity, but that is the first step towards eliminating it, is to make people aware that there's something that should be dealt with, and that in fact the allegations are credible, that these are not just claims of NGOs or crazy exile groups or political opponents, but these are real atrocities that took place. So I agree that it highlights the failure of any action to be taken, but that is the, you know, it's acknowledging the problem is the first step to sort of solution in very banal terms. Norm erosion over time, that's a really interesting point. I mean, you know, I think in a way it sort of, you know, takes us back to the very first question about, you know, all the ways in which the UN has not been able to either stop atrocities or cause governments to deal with them after the fact. And certainly, you know, there's a very rich academic debate about to what extent norms continue to exist if they're routinely violated, and, you know, how can we say that the ban on torture is use Kogan's when half the countries in the world torture. So there's some really big, you know, jurisprudential and international legal questions there. I guess I would say that I don't actually think that the norms are eroding in the sense that there are still many states, important states, that follow the rules most of the time, and there are significant enough negative reactions to violations that countries and occasionally individuals do face consequences. Now, you know, that might be seen as a bit too, you know, rosy-eyed, but I think that there is an understanding that the norms matter, but I don't think we should kid ourselves that, you know, these commissions have not brought a miraculous end to either violations of human rights law or of international humanitarian law. It's like Humphrey said, you know, this takes a very, very long time. We are already in a very, very different position from where we were in 1945 in terms of what's tolerable for states to do. And one can hope that maybe in, you know, 30 or 40 years we'll be in a different position with respect to individual accountability as well.
It's going to be 70 years very soon that the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg said in a famous sentence in its judgment that crimes are committed by men, not by abstract entities. And the question that I think is at the heart of the discussion today is whether that is actually a helpful way of putting the issue or actually part of the problem. It's quite symptomatic that Professor Ratner presented a picture of accountability that was actually quite complex, and in my understanding, in which individual criminal accountability was one facet of a multifaceted process. And nevertheless, much of what we spend the discussion time relates to individual criminal accountability. And it speaks to the nature of the criminal process, which is a narrative about the guilt or non-guilt of one person. It tends to reduce a very complex story to the story of one man, usually one man, but some rare women have been prosecuted as well. And I'm, you know, the story that we need to tell is a story that is as complex as the one that underpins the crime itself. I'm very skeptical of the whole notion of a culture of impunity as something that pushes, that triggers these types of crimes. People do not decide, you know, oh, we're going to kill all the Tutsis because we'll get away with it. The narrative is never about impunity. The narrative is always justificatory. You know, we'll do it because it's necessary for whatever reason the particular situation relates to. And this is the narrative that needs to be addressed through accountability processes. And I'm skeptical that individual criminal accountability does that, as opposed to simply burning of a light that is so bright that it overshadows all the other ways in which accountability can be brought about. So a very rich and complex issue, and I think that we've grown richer in our understanding thanks to Professor Ratner's contribution, so I invite you to thank him along with me.
I've heard.
trying to.
Yeah. It's got to be good, though. I know Steve used to have good standards of wine consuming from Australia.
Well, Australia sets a very high bar.
I think Australia was pretty incredible when it comes to
Should we turn the system off first?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.